Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to a real special edition of ESI Bytes. You know, we traditionally have offered information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit the play button. But today we're unveiling a new look to ESI Bytes. It's an interesting show, and I think as I approach 50 in less than a week, I'm getting nostalgic and looking back in time on where we were back when I started and where we are now. And there have been so many substantial changes in how we do e-discovery. And while the legal marketplace may not have many classical entrepreneurs, it does have people who've taken risk at various times and taken positions or found themselves in situations where they realize they can improve process. And I thought it would be fun to schedule a series of these shows to talk with people who've been in that situation, maybe not classic entrepreneurs, but certainly entrepreneurial, who have shaped and continue to shape how e-discovery is handled. And I thought it would be fun to bring my good friend, recently retired Judge Facciola, in on the fun and have sort of like a chat type of a show where we share innovations that the guests have been involved in and how they've approached making changes at the organizations they've been at over their career, and then see if there are any mentoring themes we can identify from their experiences. And, you know, in trying to think of a first guest, this one was almost came out instantly in my mind. Our first guest for the show is Patrick Oot, who's a partner at Shicardi & Bacon and a longtime influencer of e-discovery trends. I mean, Patrick, you've been in so many different organizations. You've been a founding member of the e-discovery Institute, which is awfully influential. You worked in-house at Verizon and did some very innovative work studying review efficiency as director of electronic discovery there and helped Verizon to be listed in the top 10 of most innovative legal groups in 2007 by Inside Counsel magazine. And you worked in-house at the government, at the SEC, as senior special counsel for e-discovery. I don't know anyone who has had all these perspectives. And even the recent work you're doing studying predictive coding efficiency with data provided by Oracle with the eDiscovery Institute. So, you know, and now you work as a partner at a large law firm. So about the only thing you haven't done is been a judge, and maybe we'll get some mentoring advice from that on Judge Facciola, right?
That's really hard work, and I really appreciate all the amazing decisions we've received from Judge Facciola over the years. You know, I think that guiding predictive coding, you know, we've seen that from Judge Facciola. You know, we've seen sort of privileged decisions and the challenges that perhaps bubbled up to FRE 502. We've seen a lot of stuff from Judge Facciola, so I'm so excited to be here with him. He's been a great mentor to me personally throughout my career and was the inspiration for me to go and take that SEC job over a lunch that we were having so many years ago during a Friends of eDiscovery lunch that Judge Facciola and a bunch of us organized once a month or so.
Well, great. So we went through sort of your career path. We didn't talk about how you got started in eDiscovery and maybe what are some of your prouder accomplishments at each of the organizations or pick a couple.
You know, Carl, it was really happenstance and about luck. You know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. I was working on a case for Verizon as an outsider while I was going to Georgetown at night. And then one day I met Amy Melita, who was an attorney at Verizon, and she couldn't believe that I was the person that could understand spreadsheets and how to process spreadsheets. Just a computer, nerdy computer skill that I perhaps picked up over the years, it led me to meet others at Verizon, including John France, who was a great mentor to me. It kind of really launched my career. And what happened at Verizon is we saw that there was a change coming in 2006, and the e-discovery process back then was disparate and ad hoc at best. So with John's vision, we were given the ability to move forward and build one of the first e-discovery practices inside a corporation
in the country. Laura Kibbe was doing it at Pfizer, and we were doing it at Verizon at the same time, so we had a great opportunity there. I left Verizon, and I was at this fabled lunch that I was talking about at Rosa Mexicana a couple of years ago, and Judge Facciola was talking about a recent DOJ position, director of e-discovery, and he suggested all of us at the table apply for it and consider it. And I was giving it some thought, and I'm walking out the door, and another good friend and mentor, Leslie Wharton, grabbed me by the elbow and said, if you're going to work for the government, you're going to work for the SEC. Fast forward, 2 days later, I'm in the office with the head of litigation, and 4 days later, I have an offer from the agency. So it was pretty fast how that happened, and I really appreciated my time there. I learned such a total different perspective than what you'd see at a major corporation. Oftentimes at a corporation, things are driven by cost. How can we do this faster, cheaper, smarter? Whereas the government, you have other things to consider that you might not necessarily think are important in litigation. FOIA, another sort of process that is totally different, that you're not dealing with that sort of protocol in just general corporate litigation. Sort of risk on a different side of, what's going on the Hill versus what's going on in the agencies. Those are another sort of different type of landscape that we see in the government. So that kind of really led me through that time, and we developed a litigation response manual for the agency where every attorney in the agency can log into the intranet and pull down the manual on how best to handle the e-discovery process. We developed a litigation hold process for the agency. So I think Leslie and I did a great job at both the policy making or process making or guideline publication, and also really did a decent job at education. And I asked my friend Judge Facciola to come back to the agency and do a training for not just SEC employees, but all federal agency employees were invited, where he, Judge Bailson, and Judge Shinlin came in to talk about the government perspective in e-discovery. And it was a great event. Chairman Shapiro participated, the General Counsel Mark Kahn participated, and it was our first real big driver of e-discovery education in the agency. So a lot of these things, as you're seeing, are really reliant upon relationships. And I think it's important to focus on good people that have really done a great service to this community, like Judge Facciola, and really help move the ball forward on the education landscape. And that's really why we formed the Electronic Discovery Institute. We've conducted several events now over the years to really educate both government lawyers through a partnership with Georgetown University over the past few years, and also corporate counsel back to where I was when I started my career through the EDI Summit. So, throughout my career, I've always tried to pay back, and I think payback is the most important thing that we all can focus on, is how can you give back to the community, how can you make it better, and how can you help law students that are getting out of school connect with jobs. All of those things are in the back of my mind while I'm working on all these cases.
Right, this is Judge Fletcher. The curious business about this is why so many lawyers had to get this expertise postgraduate. What do you think is the best way to integrate into the law school curriculum the kind of training that these lawyers now regrettably are getting after they graduate rather than before they graduate?
So, Judge, I think that's an interesting point, and we're seeing a bit of an evolution in legal education. Mm-hmm. Very few schools give any attention to e-discovery. I think Georgetown, as we know, is one of them. You've taught a class at Georgetown. Judge Hedges has taught a class at Georgetown. And the CLE program at the school is also really committed to educating their students by allowing them to come to the program for free. I think it's more important, though, that we focus on the schools that aren't paying attention, the schools that are still thinking that this is not real law, it's more of a trade mm-hmm. practice, and it's more post-secondary, post-law school type education. That's the real problem. I think we all can see, getting out of law school, we had no idea how civil procedure really worked because it was taught from cases. And seeing the practical application of Rule 26 and how the dance is done in litigation and how it's important to do it that way, I think we've got to impose upon our law schools to do better. To do a better job at preparing students about technology, about their obligations in litigation, and focus on things that will really help their client. A side note, Casey Flaherty from Kia Motors has developed a program where he tests his lawyers that work for him about technology. Something like that in a law school environment might be helpful to get students to realize that this is important to their clients. A final thing that we really offer at EDI is we try and push out interns, we try outreach, we continue to push in law schools for folks to participate in what we do. Because it serves two purposes, right? It gets them the education they need, but more importantly, it connects them with people that can potentially hire them, which I think is, again, that strong network of people in the community is really supportive of. So I'm fully supportive, Judge, of your idea that we need to get these students into more technology-focused programs, and I'm happy to say that Georgetown seems to be leading the way there, but I'm sad to say that more schools aren't adopting the education programs.
You know, being the entrepreneur on the call, I had an idea based on your story there, Patrick, of how influential Judge Batchiol has been you in calling people together in D.C. And you look at Georgetown and all the judicial involvement in the educational programs. One of the thing to getting law schools interested is most lawyers don't consider this the practice of law. It's plumbing. It's the nuts and bolts. It's not going in the court. And mm-hmm. getting judges involved gets people interested. And I know that firsthand because in Pittsburgh we started a Friends of eDiscovery group, which meets once a quarter. We've now done it for 5 or 6 years. And I would say that without having Judge Conte and Judge Nora Berry Fisher involved personally attending almost every meeting, that's what got everyone interested. So, if there's anyone with contact with a judge that's interested in e-discovery in a local community, I would suggest, asking if they would call the dean with you and talk about the need for education. One phone call might get the attention more than a passionate lawyer asking their alumni, as an alumni, hey, I think we should offer this course, which frankly didn't work for me at my law school. I got shot down on it, so I won't mention names. So, but anyway. So Judge Batchiol, I was curious, I know you're really passionate about mentoring. I don't think anyone's ever asked you this question. Who helped mentor you?
Oh, it would take the next 3 days. I have been ridiculously lucky in my life. Almost every time I went somewhere, I found a mentor. My bosses in the U.S. Attorney's Office, to a person, are now judges, every single one of them. And, as now that I've retired and look back on that, I can't imagine anyone being as lucky as I was. So from the beginning of my career till its end, there was always someone there willing to talk to me, and that's why I feel so urgently that obligation to do it to other young people. And I've given some thought, and I'm going to talk to Pat and others about this, about trying to formalize that relationship with this mentoring within this area. I don't know how we do it, but it's absolutely crucial. And I'm looking right now at emails from my students last fall who have questions for me, and I've been able to guide them, and that's proven very valuable. So there's nothing more important than that. Isn't that right, Pat?
I would agree. I agree. And, seeing those students, Judge, that are interested in connecting out to the network, I'd be happy to facilitate any relationships. A good example of that is, you know, we recently had an intern at EDI, and he was Canadian. And lo and behold, I connected him with our friend Dominic Jarre in Canada, who's leading the Sedona Working Group on the Canadian Principles. So there's such an opportunity for students to connect with people through our networks and really sort of make positive contact and really help their career, even if it's not a job, advice on how best to move forward and focus on this particular practice area.
Yeah, so we were talking before we started the call, Patrick and I sort of had a weird quasi-mentoring relationship that I wanted to mention because it ties into a theme I've noticed, and it's sort of a recent. I partnered with an attorney in Pittsburgh named Tom Gricks probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and Tom was a chemical engineer graduate from Carnegie Mellon who was also a trial lawyer. And I'd been doing all these ESI Bytes programs about predictive coding, and I looked at Tom and I said he could go into the courtroom and clearly explain why math matters. And, you know, so we began working on projects together where I was sort of, you know, sharing what I knew about e-discovery. And then lo and behold, Global hits. He does a phenomenal job with it. And, you know, he's speaking at Georgetown every year and doing all these analyses and bringing me in. And he's mentoring me now in a lot of ways at times. And it's about working with people who've got really different backgrounds, sometimes putting differences together so that you can make a difference by not being the same as everyone else. And that's sort of an interesting theme I wanted to share. Have you, Patrick, you were saying that, you know, getting working with people that have some differences has helped you as well. You know, instead of being the same old, same old. You want to share anything on that angle, or?
Yeah. So you know, there's been a oftentimes a turn, right? You know, you could sometimes be a litigation adversary with somebody, yet, still use the opportunity to learn something. You know, we're seeing that with the sort of development of the new rules that are coming out December 1st and preparing for that grand bargain. You know, so you know, we have great plaintiffs lawyers that participate in the education process and really help, you know, folks understand the different positions. So I think you can say that there are folks on both sides of the V that can really help develop your thoughts or you know, really help develop your career. So I think that there are opportunities, again, outside of defense work, outside of corporate work, where, you know, you can take something away and have it valuable to your career.
I want to go a little deeper into a couple of the things that I know you've worked on that I view as being incredibly progressive. The initial work that you did with the Verizon data and the MCI transaction with the eDiscovery Institute, of just getting into the trenches and looking at what does it really cost with what we're doing and how can we do this with maybe technology a little bit better. I mean, did you look at that at all as a risk of, you know, everyone's doing it this way and, you know, maybe I've seen the reviews from the trenches and I understand it, you know, I mean, what was sort of your cost benefit analysis of saying, let's go in and study this?
So you have to remember back in 2005, you know, predictive coding, computer assisted review, was not a topic on the tongue of every e-discovery practitioner. It was a new idea. We won't forget Judge Facciola had one of the first opinions out in the case that still wasn't even out at the time that we were considering predictive coding. But our challenge was we're unsure how a federal agency, let's say the Department of Justice in a second request, would view our use of technology to respond to a second request. And the problem that we had was we don't have time for a do-over. Oftentimes with mergers and acquisitions, you're trying to beat the clock. In our case, we were trying to get our second request complete, or we were interested in getting filing substantial compliance before AT&T, who was conducting a very similar merger. It was our boss's thought that if somebody's going to be approved, it might, and there's only going to be one, it might be the first one. So anyhow, we didn't have the luxury of time to say, all right, stop the presses, let's go and talk to DOJ about using this technology. And now, you know, Tracy Greer has done an excellent job at DOJ in putting forth new ideas into the model second request instructions, really putting on the table some ideas that weren't on the table in 2005. So we, at the time, back in 2005, before all of this positive stuff and positive technology education at DOJ, we wanted to have something in our quiver that we could say, we took our own data, we applied this technology to our own data, and then lo and behold, we saw that it was as good as using computers in the case. Or sorry, good as using the humans in the case. In our analysis, we spent millions of dollars on review, I think we came out with a really good result that you know, it doesn't matter kind of what sort of response you're looking at. You really just have to do something that's reasonable. And in the Denver Law Review article, I did a lot of research on reasonableness and pulling it back to negligence law, and really what is reasonable is really dependent upon what the community is focused on and what they're developing. So, you know, that really kind of closed out our first foray into studies. More recently, and I think more interesting, is now that the technology has developed and there are more than just a couple of players in this space, our friends at Oracle gave us a very large set of litigation data to use. I should say, not gave us, because we've actually never seen the data. It's gone through traditional law firm vendor relationships to conduct our next study, which is we've done an analysis on 18 different service providers and how they would have responded to the litigation using their technology. We've also done five different human analyses of the same data. So we have a very good amalgam of research that has done on all different technologies, on all different processes, and our overall conclusion is very similar to what it was in the Verizon days, is that all of these technologies and all of these ways to tackle the problem are effective, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to pick one over another. You know, in our analysis, for example, we found that you know, humans are better at finding privilege. Humans are better at finding hot documents. It's just the sort of real nature of the game. And the other thing that was very interesting that we just came out with in October was the humans performed a lot better than they have performed in prior studies and prior research. So that leads us to the big question of how do you find true responsiveness, or how do you define the truth in these large data sets? So we've asked Professor Gerd Infanger and Professor Peter Glynn from Stanford University to help us find our way and create an overall analysis of truth, or what if a document is really responsive or not, not based upon the subjective analysis of one person, but a variety of different sources. And you know, they've come up with a way to tackle the problem. So I'm in the process of writing the law review article now on it. We're probably going to have the results in the next few months, at least the first phase of the results of the study out in draft form for comment. And the professors are also working on a separate project which is a statistical analysis paper as opposed to the legal analysis paper, which will be forthcoming later in the year. So we've got a lot of stuff going on, and the problem keeps changing, but it appears we have some great messaging from the community on how to handle some discovery response questions.
Do you get the sense the community embraces these ideas, or, you know, I know, Judge Fatchell, you're going to talk about knowledge transfer or ask some questions about that, but, you know, it's just when you're going against the current in the other direction, it just seems to me that, you know, a lot of people don't do that in law. You know, what helped you to go against the current? Is there anything that really got you thinking, hey, maybe we should do it something different?
I think it's the cost, right? That's the core driver. And, you know, that's the really effective point of technology. It's always been the case, right? If technology can do it faster, better, smarter, sure, let's take a look at it. But be cautious. You know, I think that the technology isn't always the solution, but it most of the time it is. And we're seeing that in the results. You know, we're seeing that in the change in the legal community. You know, just in 2014, there's been a dozen opinions on the use of predictive coding or computer-assisted review. So the change management is happening, and is it difficult? No, I don't think it's difficult if you can make your case to someone like Judge Fatchiola and say, Judge, here are the options that we're looking at, and our adversary doesn't like two of them, and one of those two is something that we really want to consider. You know, having that discussion is important for change management, and I think it's getting back to what we were talking about earlier. Education is crucial in order to continue that evolution.
So, what do you see right now as the biggest challenges in e-discovery that you're focusing on today? Is there anything that's really jumping out at you right now?
Compliance. I think financial services companies are having a tough time understanding the information governance requirements of Dodd-Frank around swap transactions particularly. I think that's a sort of leader. I also think cyber security. I know Judge Fatchiola has spoken at the RSA conference several times, and the agencies are really starting to focus on cyber compliance issues. So we'll see that as a technology issue forthcoming, and hopefully that will be resolved in the next few years. But those are probably the two major points. And then in the e-discovery world, what to do when something didn't work as the company might have thought it worked, you know, a system failure. You know, what sort of liability exists when an action that folks thought would have happened didn't actually happen properly? So that sort of that target of perhaps negligence is something that we'll see towards the end of the year as the new rules start to take grasp and really shape, you know, how do we define the problem when something goes missing and there was no real intent, it was just an accident. So I'm really looking forward to seeing those cases, to be honest, because a lot of clients are scratching their head now and wondering, you know, what the new rules will provide them is in way of savings in those very difficult cases.
So Judge Fatchiola, Patrick earlier on had mentioned you as being one of his big mentors. How do you view mentoring? I mean, is mentoring just something that comes natural to you, or do you pick people out and say, I'm going to try to help these people? Maybe you can give some advice.
The first advice, I guess, is absolute perfect candor on both sides, or it's just not going to work. You can't. It is fundamentally a relationship of friendship and admiration. If it's anything else, it's artificial and it won't work. So you have to be genuinely concerned about the welfare of the other person. And mentoring is all about advancing that and trying to get some sense of what's troubling that other person and meeting that concern and seeing if you can help them out of it. As I say, there's no such thing as forced mentoring. That's an oxymoron. It has to flow from a relationship between two people who admire and respect each other. And with young people, you have to overcome their very natural reluctance to talk to someone who is so much older. Once you get past that, it opens all new kinds of wonderful doors of an intense interest in other people.
So, Patrick, do you have any advice for younger lawyers as we sort of wind this down on how they can get, you know, mentored or find themselves in a situation where they can learn about e-discovery and maybe make a difference?
I think the first strong bit of advice I would say is follow up. I'll give you an example. On this past weekend, I was on a streetcar in New Orleans, and Judy Kelly, who works with EDI, had met a law student on the streetcar, who is a 2L, second year, and they started talking, and our next EDI summit is in New Orleans, coincidentally, and she mentioned to him, hey, you should follow up with us, and it would be an opportunity for you to meet potential employers, for you to learn something about e-discovery that you're probably not learning in law school, and you know, we gave him business cards. What I found over the years is that law students, perhaps because they're too busy on other things, they don't follow up with opportunity, and that's where they get stuck. They're so used to the traditional model of going to a hotel full of interviews with recruiters from law firms that's the process to follow in order to succeed. But in actuality, I think it's just the opposite. I think that's the wrong approach. I think relationship development is key, and following up and checking in with people. You know, if people like Judge Facciola and other attorneys that who honestly bill by the hour and really have a defined vision of what the value of their time is, when they make time for young people, I think it's very important for the young people to take advantage of it as much as possible. It's such an opportunity and such a potential for growth. And if you don't, you're going to be stuck in the statistics pool with competing against everybody else for the very few jobs that exist that are based upon the numbers of your GPA and who you clerked beforehand.
I couldn't agree with you more. My view in law school is so much of it's determined right when you walk through the law school. If it's a top 20 law school, because that's where the law firms, all the mega firms recruit at, and then how you did on your grades. And, you know, that's silly. You get an opportunity to meet people and learn and interact, and you know that's how you get beyond your first job anyway. So I think that's great advice. Really appreciate that. So I think since you mentioned billable time, I know you're on the clock. why don't we wrap up this call at this point? I think it's fantastic that you joined us on this show to share some of your knowledge, Patrick, about, you know, making a difference and in the field, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you and other people like you later this year. And I also want to thank Judge Facciola for joining us to sharing this important message. I'd like to thank Jurnaw for their continued support of ESI Bytes, and to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. And as we always say, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about e-discovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.